Donald Miller said heroes and villains have the same backstory, pain. The only difference between them is how they respond to pain. The villain says, the world hurt me, I'm going to hurt it back. And the hero says, the world hurt me, I'm not going to let it hurt anyone else. How does past pain relate to someone developing dark personality traits?
Okay. There's quite some literature and research around the role of trauma or adverse childhood experiences in relation to the dark traits, and in particular in relation to psychopathy and narcissism. I might want to clarify for those who don't know what the dark traits are. This is a constellation of personality traits that have some maladaptive unusual features such as callousness and unemotional underpinnings, etc. So we have the traits of psychopathy, narcissism, Machiavellianism in the dark triad, but also more recently added sadism as a fourth one in the dark tetrad. These are the dark traits. So there's a lot of research that looks at these in combination, the dark trait research, but then there's also lots of research that looked at these constructs individually. Okay. And so, for example, in the psychopathy literature, often within the forensic and clinical literature, background in terms of past trauma or adverse childhood experiences like neglect has been looked at. And what we know from in psychopathy, for example, is that there seems to be an elevated rate, and there's an which might be implicated in the development of this kind of personality disorder. So for some individuals, that is indeed the case, but not always. So some people differentiate between a primary and a secondary psychopath. And for example, in primary psychopathy, research had shown that there's more of a genetic biological underpinning. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the secondary psychopath, who is more vulnerable, has high levels of anxiety and is a bit more threat responsive. Mm-hmm. These individuals often had a poor socioeconomic background and or adverse childhood experiences in the background, or poor peer relationships, so poor peer groups that are involved in gang violence, etc., for example. Right. Mm-hmm. So for some, the environmental aspect was more important, and for others, the biological aspects were more important. So we differentiate there slightly. But it is a possibility. Some people have experienced these adverse childhood experiences, and these may have then fostered an attachment style and interpersonal style that was not beneficial for the individual and leading to the manifestation of personality disturbances or disorders later on in life.
Mm. And is this also the case for narcissism, Machiavellianism and sadism, not just psychopathy? It can be genetic and environmental for all of those.
I think for all of those. Generally, everything is an interaction between genetic and environmental underpinnings. I think in psychopathy, most research have been done in terms of biological underpinnings. So we know a lot more there than we know, for example, in sadism or in Machiavellianism. But more research needs to be done really to disentangle that. But we know, for example, in young people and children, we have this concept called callous unemotional traits. And when you look at children who show problematic behaviors, so conduct problems, for example, you can differentiate these children into two subgroups, one with callous unemotional traits and one without callous unemotional traits. And the ones that come with the callous unemotional traits, there's a much greater heritability factor there, so more biological underpinning. There's more severe and more long-lasting behavioral difficulties. There's less treatment responsiveness and so on and so forth. So if we have this kind of biological underpinning there, and the outcomes are worse than they were in the kids who didn't have these callous and emotional traits. And callous and emotional traits are also at the core of the dark traits later in adulthood.
Okay. And there's one dark personality trait that you haven't mentioned that you've done a lot of research on and that we were talking about before we started recording, which is dark empaths. What are dark empaths for someone who hasn't heard of this term before? And why should people maybe be worried about knowing one?
Okay. So dark empaths are individuals who have elevated dark traits. And this is then the combination of psychopathic, narcissistic, Machiavellian traits, because we looked at the dark triad in this particular research. But later on, we also looked at the dark tetrad, and we're seeing the same pattern. So people who have elevated traits in those dark domains, and they come with a combination of empathic capacities. So traditionally, we always assumed, or generally assumed, that the dark traits are underpinned by reduced empathy, a lack of empathy, or empathic difficulties. Okay. But there were a few inconsistencies in terms of, you know, mixed findings in the literature as well. So that we then thought, okay, if these individuals are particularly manipulative, they're very deceitful, they're good at lying, etc. In order to be able to do this, you must have some empathic capacities. And that's what we call cognitive empathy. A cognitive empathy is about, I know what you are thinking right now, and that's why I can predict what you're going to do next. I can predict your behavior on the basis of what I know you know, okay? Or what I tell you, and then I know what you're going to do on the basis of that. So this is a cognitive capacity to empathize, a perspective taking, basically, okay? But there's also affective empathy, and affective empathy is more about, I can feel what you are feeling. If you're upset, I will feel upset. If you're crying, it will make me want to cry, or makes me want to console you to make you feel better, right? So this is our affective capacity. This is, we are actually having the feelings, can mirror the feelings that somebody else is having. Okay. And so the research has started to differentiate, taking a fine cuts approach, these different types of empathy. And what we have seen is that particularly in psychopathy, for example, there are difficulties in processing other people's distress. So they don't necessarily recognize when somebody is sad or frightened. Fear and sad in particular are the emotions that are compromised. Although again, the studies differ there slightly in terms of the findings, but this is, you know, one of the strongest findings. And so the notion, the theories in this area, and a lot of the studies that try to test this and showed evidence towards this, is that because there is this processing deficit of other people's distress, they are not inhibited in terms of their violence. So if we shout at someone and the other person gets sad and or starts crying, we will naturally stop. We have this inhibition mechanism that makes us stop aggressing against someone who is upset. Animals have the same. Dogs will do that. If the other dog's, dog lies on its back and shows its belly as a clear distress sign, the other dog will stop playing so rough, for example, okay? If they're healthy. And so we see this in the psychopathy research and plenty of studies showing this from on a physiological level as well as on a psychological level, some behavioral level in terms of their responses in experiments, for example. So the baseline assumption was always they lack empathy and that's why they're aggressing. However, when we are looking at the more general population and these elevated dark traits, we realize that the findings are a little bit more mixed, sometimes not quite showing this reduced empathy or mixed levels of empathy. So we thought, okay, are there different types, different profiles of dark trait individuals? Are there those who lack empathy and therefore they have these more aggressive tendencies? Or are there those who might have more elevated empathic capacities and henceforth they inhibit their aggression somewhat or completely? We don't know. Right. So we run this big study and we tested about almost 1,000 individuals from this, you know, normal population, from the general population. And we measured their dark traits and we measured their different empathic capacities and affective, cognitive, and so forth. And then we run a statistical analysis called latent profile analysis. So what this analysis does, it will find clusters of people who respond similarly across the dark traits and across the empathy, and then the different combinations of those. And we identified four profiles. One profile was a typical profile with low dark traits and average levels of empathy, what we'd expect. That was the biggest profile. Then we had one profile with low dark traits and very high levels of empathy. So these are the empaths that we also know of, that people exist who are very agreeable, very friendly, very nice, and very empathic. Okay. Then we had the third group. The third group was the one that scored high on the dark traits and really low on empathy. And this is across both affective and cognitive empathy. Okay. So these we termed our traditional dark traits. And then the fourth group was our dark empath group. So this was a novel construct, and the surprising finding there that we had a profile that's got really high on dark traits, same as the other one, but it had elevated and more than typical levels of empathy.
Wow.
So slightly more, not as high as the empaths, but they were in between the empaths and the typicals, right? So they had elevated capacity to both cognitively and effectively empathize. And then we compared them on a range of different outcome measures, for example, the indirect aggression. So this is to what extent do they socially exclude other people, spread rumors and gossip about others, use malicious humors to put people down, these kind of not direct, but more indirect aggressive behaviors. And we could see that the dark empaths were significantly less aggressive than the traditional dark trait group. So the empathy kind of pushed the aggressive tendencies down. However, they weren't clear, completely clear or clean, because they were still higher than the typicals and the empaths. Okay, so they are still aggressive, but the aggression is somewhat inhibited. Okay. We have also replicated that since in other studies that they are not published yet, but we looked at more direct forms of aggression, like reactive and proactive types of aggression. And again, we're seeing a slightly lower level in some studies. And in some studies, we see similar levels. So the empathy changes the profile and the outcomes, but it doesn't make them completely nice people. Right. Mm-hmm. So they were more agreeable, for example, than the traditional dark traits, but still less agreeable and less friendly and less trustworthy than the typicals and the empaths. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they have somewhere in between there in terms of the empathy helps them to regulate a little bit more those maladaptive outcomes. That's what we see. They're also more extroverted, so they're probably socially more adept. They're more likely to have friends because of their empathic capacities. They can probably interact better with other people.
Mm-hmm. And what percentage of the population or the study that you did were dark empaths?
About 13%. 13, yeah, 13.
That's quite high, isn't it?
We would expect relatively. It was the dark traits. So the ones that are lacking the empathy are 13%. Let me just clarify that. And the ones that are the dark empaths were almost 20%. So they're even a little bit more. So both together, we are looking about a third of the population that has these high dark traits and then different levels of empathy. These are dark traits. So these are questions about how much do you care about others, or how ruthless are you, or how manipulative are you, how strategic are you, how pragmatic are you, how cynical are you, these type of things, yeah? So these are not questions. So this is not an assessment of a clinical or forensic construct of psychopathy. We are not looking at personality disorders here. Okay. We are just looking at some of these traits that are a little bit more rough, tough, and tumble, and a bit more colors, and a little bit more assertive, and a little bit more, you know, less agreeable in a sense, and a bit more antagonistic. So, and we know that having these elevated traits also then leads to more maladaptive outcomes in terms of interpersonal relationships, relationship satisfaction, in terms of successes and personal and occasional lives, in terms of aggression more generally, or antisocial behavior and so on. So if these traits are elevated, you know, there is a risk for being, for having more maladaptive outcomes. But these are not criminal. These are not, you know, serial killers. They're just a percentage of the population that is more callous than the rest of the population.
Mm. Yeah. And what causes someone, do you think, to be a dark empath? We were talking about the ratio between genetic and environmental. But I was thinking with the dark empath, it might relate to the quote that I had said at the start, where it was like, do you think something happened in their childhood, some trauma, where they may have been an empath before, but then that trauma may have caused them to become a dark empath. So they kept the empathy, but now they had the dark traits because of the trauma that happened. Do you think that's maybe a cause of this?
Yes, I mean, it could be, right? We don't know for sure. We are currently running a study that is looking at, more generally at trauma. and adverse childhood experiences, and then links to various different outcomes. In the study, we have also measured the dark traits. So we are examining the role of trauma in the dark traits in combination with this. It is with everything, you know, that there's never one clear answer as to what might lead to the manifestation of these traits. But often, if you have more hostile environments you're growing up in, if you have more tough environments, then it's functional for you to adapt to those environments. So personality is a reflection of our experiences, our genetic and biological underpinning in combination with the experiences we have encountered. Okay. And as with general personality disorders, for example, we always assume it's a manifestation through our childhood into adulthood. And that's when we get an expression of a personality disorder, for example. So like narcissistic personality disorder or psychopathy or antisocial personality disorder, etc. And so adverse childhood experience are generally across the board often implicated in the development of those. Okay. And you're quite right. So we would assume that our affective empathy is something that starts quite early in infancy. So we are already seeing in babies, for example, in very young infants, if the mother looks scared, if they try to touch something that's dangerous, the child will understand this and will pull back, right? Mm. So in a sense, they're processing this affective state. Also, children or infants are very good, and if their caregiver or mother, in this case, cries, they will come and try to walk and make her feel better, okay? So infants have the affective empathic capacities well before they develop cognitive capacities. That comes later. It comes with 4 or 5 years. They start developing perspective taking and a theory of mind, etc. Because you need more higher cognitive processes for this. But the affective states are there beforehand. An affective state, affective empathy is something you can conceptualize as, I don't know, have you ever had the experience when you see something really sad or something that you get the goosebumps?
I normally get it when I listen to music. That might be different though.
Yes, but the same. It puts you into an affective state. And if the music is very intense and very sad, it evokes an emotion and you take this emotion on. Okay. And you might get these goosebumps. We can also get it when we hear something very exciting. Okay. It's an arousal level. So we are getting aroused on the basis of the emotion that we are processing. And so this is a bodily physiological reaction, okay? And if you don't have these arousal states, if you don't get excited when something exciting is happening, or you don't get into an aversive state when something distressing is happening, then that's a problem. Okay, and that will manifest into problems because you will never build the same kind of bonding and relationships with others. When we see someone in distress, when a child falls over and cries, we want to go and help and pick them up, okay? And that's a natural altruistic response. It's a helping response and this is also to alleviate our own aversive state, not just the aversive state of the other person, but also our own state that is unpleasant because we're feeling for the other person and with the other person, okay? And in order to alleviate our own aversive state, and that we need to alleviate their aversive state. So this is the models around the helping behavior, for example, okay? And this kind of violence inhibition mechanism that we see in psychopathy that is dysfunctional, okay? They don't show the physiological response in relation to somebody else's distress. So they have reduced heart rate, they have reduced sweat generation, their brain function is reduced and different. So their amygdala, for example, and which processes social reinforcement, stimuli and information, in particular threat information, okay, it is not activated in the same way as in non-psychopathic individuals.
Wow. And is it in that situation where something that a non-psychopathic person sees as distressing, they would have that physiological reaction? When the person that is a psychopath or has psychopathic traits sees something that's perceived as distressing for most people, the general population, is it just they don't feel anything, they just feel neutral, or is it they actually get pleasure from seeing the distress, or is that a different trait?
Okay.
Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
So I wouldn't necessarily say that they don't feel anything. I think everything is on a range of
spectrum.
To what extent. And so, yeah. So there will be some feeling. So they will still generate maybe some heartbeat or arousal levels. So there were some really classic studies called the startle paradigm. And many, 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 many years ago when I did my PhD, I just done this in the clinical psychopathic populations and forensic context. But I replicated this also in the general population on the basis of high personality traits and this kind of psychopathic traits rather than full-blown psychopathy. And what we see is, this paradigm is quite an interesting, if you are really interested in the physiology of this. But when we are exposing, let's say we are watching pictures or video clips, okay, and they can be quite neutral, they can be quite positive, and they can be negative or frightening, okay? And in this case, many studies used back in the day, and I'm talking a couple of decades ago and longer, they used pictures, okay? And then we would measure the heart rate, their skin conductance, so how much they sweat. And we can also measure something called a startle response. So this is a response, a reflex that you can't manipulate, okay? You can't control it. So when I startle you, when I jump out, that jump scares, you automatically, your eye will blink, okay? And it will blink more the more startled you are because your body contracts, your muscle contracts, and it goes, okay? So we've been measuring this in psychopathic individuals, non-psychopathic, or in my case, and those with higher psychopathic traits and those with low psychopathic traits. And what we see is when people look at pleasant pictures or videos, they're in a more relaxed state of mind. So you don't tense up as much, so your startle response is much smaller than it would be otherwise, okay? If you're watching a horror film or some really threatening image, you are in a more tense motivational state. So when a startle probe occurs and there's a loud noise burst in your ear, you will shrug. And that shrug tends to be intensified. So it's a magnified response. Okay, that's normally what happens. But in psychopaths, their response to fearful images and videos would be very similar to appetitive or neutral ones. So it's really reduced. It's really kind of inhibited rather than exaggerated. Okay, this is the blink. Mm. But then we also see in terms of the arousal levels, whether skin conductance or heart rate, they're not more aroused or more unpleasantly aroused than in comparison to neutral or maybe more positive stimuli. Whereas in healthy, non-psychopathic individuals, we see that higher arousal levels in those cases. So we can say that physiologically, they don't respond as intensely to these fearful or sad images, for example, as we would normally see. So that's one thing. Now, the second question you raised there, whether some individuals might show elevated arousal, but it's a different kind of arousal. And that's correct. This is what we're assuming, for example, in the context of sadism.
Yeah.
The conceptualization of this construct itself is that they get aroused when they hurt someone. So they induce the pain to get pleasure from it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that can be sexually or non-sexual, different types of sadism. So the idea is that they get aroused, but the affect that's being generated is different, is incongruent. So they inflict pain or hurt someone, they don't feel unpleasant, they feel more pleasant.
Mm. Okay.
So there's this what we call dissonant empathy. So you are generating some feelings, but they are dissonant to the actual emotion that is being seen. So Schadenfreude, for example, is a concept that might fall into that kind of area. So we would expect much higher levels of Schadenfreude in those individuals. So they see someone fall over and they're really enjoying it, for example. Okay. So at the moment, one of my PhD students, she has been studying quite a lot because she was trying to delineate psychopathy and sadism to see whether is it in psychopathy a complete kind of lack of response. I don't really care, neither positively nor negatively. It's just it doesn't bother me. Whereas in sadism, there might be this, I'm enjoying this, right? Yeah. I'm enjoying seeing you in pain. And so she's been testing these two traits to try and delineate and see whether they have these different levels and whether in sadism it is indeed this kind of more reactiveness to somebody's distress, whereas in psychopathy, the reduced reactiveness to the stress. So we are still analyzing some of the data, but they're not as easily differentiated as we think they are. There are a lot of commonalities, but there are also some differences in terms of their underpinning empathic capacities. So we certainly see that dissonant empathy in sadism, absolutely, but we also see it in psychopathy somewhat. So the psychopaths are also engaging in Schadenfreude.
Okay. And how come masochism isn't on the tetrad, or does it count as a dark personality trait still?
It's typically or traditionally not necessarily studied within the dark traits. Often people will look at it or control for it when they study sadism. Because I think in masochism, the difference is that a lot of the mutual pain that is given is consensual, right? So, and also they like to receive, and it's often within this kind of more kind of consensual realm of sexual masochism, for example. So it's not quite the same as what we're looking at in sadism. The sadism is about really hurting someone else and intentionally harming someone else who is motivated to avoid this harm. This is a definition of aggression and violence, is that the other people, they don't want to get them. There's a victim involved and there's a perpetrator involved. Yeah. And so maybe that's why the masochism is often treated a little bit as an extra separate construct, sometimes controlled for in the sadism studies, but it's not generally part of the dark triad or tetrad in this case.
Okay. And in terms of dark empaths, what are maybe three signs that someone is a dark empath that people can look out for?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you're looking at the dark traits, and very clear signs is this callousness and antagonism. Okay. They're not the nicest people, but they might have some empathic capacities. So they will care about what you have to say. They will listen about what they might even help you, but often with some kind of ulterior motive or intent. So it needs to benefit them in some way. Okay. The dark traits are typically quite selfish and it's about them rather than about others. Okay. So they're also quite good maybe in terms of their perspective taking. They might be good in terms of giving you advice as to what you should and shouldn't be doing, but they might also try and manipulate you at the same time. So they seem caring and they seem to be understanding you, but often the outcome of this or the ulterior motive of this might be something more benefiting to them. So that would be where I would keep it. And, these are, 20% of dark empaths. These are general people from the general population. They might, because they're quite extroverted, they're probably quite sociable. They might be quite fun to be around with sometimes, but they might not be your closest friends. They might not be the ones you want to open your heart to, because they might use it for their own advantage, right? So it's that dark. The empathy is nice, it's good. Somebody cares for you and understands you. But if that comes alongside with those dark aspects, like callousness or sometimes hostility or cynical or strategic manipulativeness, that's the thing that should raise an alarm bell.
And is that what makes it so dangerous? Is they maybe shower you with empathy and then the dark traits are revealed later into the relationship? What makes a dark empath so dangerous compared to other ones?
Yeah, I still think the traditional dark traits are more dangerous.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I know that there's been that notion that, these are the most, really strictly speaking, it's the traditional dark traits that are the more aggressive, the more disagreeable. They're probably, because they really don't care. Okay. So you don't, these are the ones you don't necessarily want to have as your friends. keep them away as much as possible because they really won't care. They're ruthless. Okay. They'll go and do for whatever is best for them. With the dark empaths, they are dangerous in a different way, dangerous in a way that you might miss it. And dangerous in a way that it will take you longer, as you just rightly said, it will take you longer to recognize because they seem to be caring and they seem to be understanding. And yet there's still that nasty nature to them as well. Okay, so it will maybe just take you that little bit longer to figure out. And we know this in many relationship cases. Sometimes people are, you know, in relationships for years and then realize that the other partner has been gaslighting them, has been manipulative, has been quite narcissistic. And, you know, and then the relationships break apart. And then people wonder, how did I never pick up on this sooner?
And you know? So what are some tips for someone who might be in a relationship with a dark empath? How can they detect one and what should they do if they realize?
I think if you realize that there are these antagonistic, selfish levels and that there's always that kind of meanness to it in some way and that they're putting you down, etc. In the long term, it will wear you down. Right? In the long term, they can be quite manipulative in some way and you don't even realize it. It can be quite subtle and step by step and they will wear you down. So it's important to pick up on this as soon as possible. And when you do, to protect yourself, okay? To protect your self-esteem, to protect your self-worth, and to understand, look, maybe there's nothing wrong with you as a person. If these individuals trying to put you down, belittle you, diminish you, demean you, etc. So it's, first of all, that understanding for your self-protection. But then there's also the notion that often people might think, oh, I can change them. You know, I'll try and change. And then... the more, if you try, so for example, if you have an highly narcissistic individual and you're trying to tell them how they are being, why are they being so selfish? Why are they being so entitled to just do whatever they want to do, even if that has a detriment to the other person, right? They won't see it. They won't necessarily, it's not, I don't think, you know, you can't, it's quite difficult to change the leopard spots. And I'm not saying that they can't be treated or helped in clinical context. Yes, of course, there are therapies available, but in a general normal interaction for normal people, we don't necessarily have those skill sets to be able to do this, right? So you need to think, first of all, you're probably not going to change them. At anything you put towards them in terms of what might be their weaknesses, they will not recognize. Mm-hmm. There's a complete lack of insight in that case. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, there won't be necessary any change or motivation to change.
Yeah.
Because they see nothing wrong with them. And psychopathic individuals, as far as they're concerned, everybody else is weak and they are strong and what they are doing is fine, right?
Yeah.
So there's no motivation in changing. So in the long term, it's a big question. Do you want to put up with this or do you want to cut your losses, move on and find a more healthier relationship and come out of this toxicity? Because it can become really toxic all the time.
Definitely. And what inspired you to study the dark personality traits? Were there any experiences or relationships that you had that motivated you to get into all of this?
No. but no, back then when I started, I was always interested in the concept of psychopathy and of why is it that some people are so cold and, you know, lacking emotions. And you know, when I was younger, I was very interested in kind of criminal cases and serial killer. Funnily enough, I've read a lot of Sherlock Holmes as well, which as a child, which I found really interesting. And so I was always wondering about the motives of people and how they are the way they are. And so naturally, I moved into the study of personality more generally, but then also specifically into the study of aggression and the maladaptive traits that are underpinning aggressive and antisocial behavior. So in specifically, the best one to study there is psychopathy. And once you study psychopathy, you also start studying then the other dark traits in combination.
Okay. And how has being aware of these dark personality traits helped you maybe detect certain traits in other people or help you avoid certain relationships, or has it at all? Have you fallen into any traps yourself?
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I have maybe a little bit more awareness around people's behavior and maybe a bit more understanding kind of where it might come from. It helps me in a way sometimes understanding when some people behave angry or aggressively. There might be something different underpinning. It might be a threat underpinning that they feel threatened or frightened or anxious or stressed, right? So it can go the other way. So in which case, sometimes they need help.
Mm.
Okay. So I often, when I see someone behaving badly, I might pay that little bit more attention to see where is this coming from and is there something they need, rather than just assuming as a baseline, everyone is a psychopath.
Yeah.
Because that would not be a healthy way of looking at things, of course. But also at the same time, so for example, in work contexts or in other kind of friendship contexts, if I intuitively feel at unease with a person and I don't like the way they are and how they're behaving towards others or towards me, I cut my losses off. I make decisions who I'm holding at arm's length and who's a person I can trust, who's a person I can talk to about my innermost deep feelings, and who's a person I'd rather stay away with and might not want to work with, for example, because I feel like they're going to take advantage, right?
Yeah.
So you just get a little bit more intuitive around these things, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And are there any early common behaviors or signs that you've picked up on over your years of experience that could indicate, okay, I need to keep this person arm's length away rather than getting them into my inner circle?
Yeah, sure. You know, if you have, it's quite interesting, especially like, you know, as a female in academia, it's a job, you know, you have to, you work hard and in academia, you have to work hard to get somewhere, but sometimes you might find other people. We often have to collaborate with other people. We have to work with other people. It's good to network. It's good to have healthy working relationships. And you need to have different strengths in a team, right? And it's not just in academia, it's in any workplace, I guess, where teamwork is important. And if you find some people are not either not interested in pulling their way towards the teamwork or not appreciating you as a person and what you can bring towards the team, and then or undermining you as a person, then this is the point at which you need to be thinking very carefully as to, do you really want to work with this person? Do you have to, you know? And it took me a few years because, and it comes probably with the years of working and having greater networks and getting more people to know that I can make very wise decisions now who I would like to work with and who not. And usually I prefer the people who are nice, the people that we can get on well with personally, not just on a job basis. And I think that's really important. So if you can sync with someone, if you can connect with someone more meaningfully in a, you know, happy way and you feel happy working with them, then that's great. And that's what you want.
Right? Yeah.
Because you don't, you know, if you spend the majority of your time at a workplace and you have to work with people that make you miserable or unhappy or deflate your self-esteem, then, you know, that's not a healthy way. So setting your boundaries becomes really important. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is something that I worked on over the years. It's not something that comes naturally, especially if we're more junior. You know, we want to get on with everyone and we don't, you know, and the thing is, one thing to learn probably as well is it's almost maybe not so much of a point to try and talk a narcissist or a person who is psychopathic into understanding and becoming more nice and why are you being this way? Because they don't care. So what you do is you just hold them at arm's length, turn the other way and find your happiness.
Yes.
Don't stick in that miserable situation.
Definitely. And if you're, you know, in the dating sphere, you're single and you're going on some dates, maybe first, second and third date, from your experience, what are some warning signs you should look out for, but also some positive signs that you should look out for that indicate that this could be the right partner for you?
Okay. Warning signs. So these individuals might be, they like admiration. Okay. They have sometimes quite grandiose sense of self. They will show off. they will like other people to look at them and admire them. That's a very narcissistic, typical thing, right? And the psychopathic thing is more about being quite ruthless and quite horrible. So yeah. anyone who is horrible towards waiters or towards, that's a red flag to me because there's no need. Okay. Yeah. You can be respectful. And so that would be a red flag. Somebody who's constantly showing off and needing that admiration and feeling quite entitled to have and do what they want to do and not really taking you into consideration, definite red flag. Hmm. Somebody who is quite sly and trying to manipulate you or being quite strategic in trying to, you know, push you into a certain direction that you don't feel comfortable with, another red flag.
Hmm.
The things to look out for, what is nice is if you, let's say if you meet someone and you're telling them something just on the side, something that you've been doing or something that's going on, let's say at your work, okay, just very briefly. And then you meet them again, maybe a few weeks later, and they will ask you, oh, how did that go? You know, did it go all right for you? What that means is they actually listened and they actually cared. And they remembered and they will not come back to this. Okay. And they will make sure they will check in to make sure you're okay. So which probably shows true concern. Now it could be a manipulative strategy. The really true Machiavellians might master this as well, but the psychopaths won't do that. And narcissists are probably not bothered about your problem anyways as well. So in a sense, it's almost that caring that stretches over time as well, that is not just in that moment pretentiously kind of, you know, put there as if, yeah, I do really care. But it's also, does that caring last? And is there some checking in?
Mm.
So that would show some true listening and empathic capacity. Also that they're kind. Also that they're accepting sometimes that, you know, you might need to do your thing and that you also have needs and they'll be willing, you know, to sacrifice their own good for your needs. Okay. Mm. So it's not just about them. It's then also about you.
Mm, okay. That's good. And Machiavellianism is one that I wasn't aware of. I was aware of psychopathy. I was aware of grandiose narcissism and sadism. I feel like Machiavellianism, from what I've researched and watched and listened to, not as many people talk about it. Mm-hmm. What are the differences? What differs? What makes Machiavellianism a separate personality trait or personality disorder versus the other ones? What are some behaviors that they do that maybe narcissists and psychopaths and sadists don't do?
Okay. So it's an interesting one. So Machiavellianism is not a personality disorder. It's not listed as a PD. It's a trait, simply a trait. And interestingly enough, there's quite a good kind of rich literature out there that argues more or less that there's no distinction between Machiavellianism and psychopathy.
Wow.
So some people say that essentially, so you know how I said earlier, sometimes they're studied together. As a triad or tetrad, and sometimes they are studied within each field individually, right? And so those who study within the psychopathy field individually would argue that Machiavellianism is a manifestation of what we call primary psychopathy, or within the clinical, so within the clinical forensic concept of psychopathy as a full-blown construct. You have different factors that come together. And these are four. The gold standard model by Robert Hare is very famous. A framework is a four-factor model. And you have the interpersonal style and the affective style, which are forming the first two clusters. And the manipulativeness would be part of this interpersonal style.
Okay. Mm.
So being strategic, cynical, manipulative is part of the psychopathy diagnosis within the clinical field. So that's why you will not find Machiavellianism as a separate clinical construct as such. And so even when we are studying the dark traits and combinations, usually the correlation between psychopathy and Machiavellianism tends to be much higher than between narcissism, and they are less delineated, whereas narcissism and psychopathy are more different in some way. Okay. And so some might argue that Machiavellianism is just part of that strategic, manipulative, ruthless strategy of the psychopath.
Yeah, okay. So it's more just a very major trait of a psychopath rather than its own separate thing.
Within the clinical field, yes. When we are studying it subclinically, you can measure Machiavellianism as a separate trait, and it's very much about that pragmatism, about the strategic nature. And it's less to do with the psychopathy conceptualized here would be more about this ruthlessness, impulsivity, and deceitfulness, although lying and also falls into the field of Machiavellianism, because if you want to manipulate, you have to lie. So here we have the slightly more really don't care type individual, ruthless and cold, okay, cold-hearted. And then you have the Machiavellian who might care to some extent, but care to make sure this works out for their own as well.
Yep.
So being very strategic in that sense. So it's probably seen in a slightly more adaptive way than we would see it in the clinical field, let's say.
Okay. And what's the difference between narcissism and psychopathy, or the fundamental differences?
So in narcissism, you have that really grandiose sense of self and that admiration. So, you know, from the old classic kind of mythology, the notion of Narcissus falling in love with himself as he sees his mirror image in the lake.
Yeah.
And they really are extremely self-concerned and extremely, and they have a massive, you know, a massive sense of grandiosity in terms of what they can do and what they're able to do and how good they are at things. Okay. Whereas a psychopath maybe cares a bit less. It's not, they're not so much grandiose. They're not, they don't have a need to tell everyone how great they are necessarily, because they don't care. Everyone else is a loser. Right. And they don't care. They don't want, they don't necessarily need that admiration. However, again, when you look at the clinical diagnostics, you will see an inflated sense of self-worth also in the clinical diagnostics of psychopathy, probably because it gets subsumed. So what I think what it says here in some ways is that they have to have some narcissistic tendencies and selfishness, self-centeredness, that egocentricity, that they are the most important, whatever they want, they can get because they're the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's part of this clinical construct. In a subclinical realm of personality traits, we would try and distinguish that a little bit more. And so, yeah, you will always find with all disorders in the end, there are some symptoms will be overlapping across disorders, right? And some will be more unique to each disorder. And whether we are looking at kind of more access one anxiety or stressor-related disorders, there is also some overlap, right? And so the same we can see with the personality disorders, there's often some overlap. Like impulsivity, for example, is a trait or construct that features in many, many different disorders. Because it is about that emotion dysregulation and all this dysregulation of motor function, let's say, as well, depending on what type of impulsivity you look at. So some symptoms are really kind of almost transdiagnostic.
Yeah.
And so the callousness and the lack of empathy was always that transdiagnostic sign that we, for example, see in narcissism as well in psychopathy.
And so is the self-absorption almost covert in psychopaths and overt in narcissists? You know, the narcissists need it from others, but the psychopaths have a superiority complex, but they don't need that validation from everyone else. Is that a fundamental difference between the two?
It could be, yes. So there might be that psychopaths don't care what other people are thinking. They are not concerned about other people. They just do whatever they need to do to get their goal, to get what they want. A narcissist, they are quite keen on other people. admiring them and showing that off and showing how great they are and having that entitlement. And one interesting thing that might be slightly different. So what we see in psychopath is that what we call lack of fear. So we have lack of empathy that was thought to be across them. But obviously our dark empaths blew that a little bit out of the water because it's not always the case. Now, I just want to clarify here. This is all at the clinical level. If we are looking now at clinical levels of psychopathy, diagnosed narcissistic personality disorder, etc., I don't know whether there would be. I almost don't think there would be because it's part of the diagnosis that they lack that empathy. So we might not see a dark empath at clinical high levels, but we might differentiate it better within the general population. But just by the way. But the other hallmark, big hallmark in psychopathy is the lack of fear. Remember I told you earlier about the startle response, that they have the diminished startle response to fearful stimuli. Oh, when they watch horror films, for example, they wouldn't jump out. Okay. And that, I don't think, is the case for narcissism. Although it would be a really interesting thing to actually test whether we see how the fear response and avoidance response is developed in the narcissist. Now, generally, it's not a known hallmark for narcissists. And in fact, what you see in narcissistic individuals is that we differentiate between the grandiose narcissist and a vulnerable narcissist. Mm. And the vulnerable narcissist tends to have high anxiety levels and a greater threat response and particularly strong. So they have lower levels of self-esteem as well. So you see a much stronger response to ego threat then as well.
Mm. Is that the same as covert or inverted narcissism? Is that the same thing? Yeah.
You have overt and covert, or we call it, it's more like most people call it vulnerable and grandiose narcissism. Mm. Yeah, because we are seeing some vulnerability in terms of their emotion and dysregulation and in terms of their vulnerability to their ego as well.
Yeah. And what are some behaviors of vulnerable narcissists that aren't shown in the typical grandiose narcissist?
Now you would see more emotion dysregulation. So more emotionality and more anxiety, for example. Yeah. They might react with more emotionally dysregulated behavior if you tell them they're not so great, right? Mm. So the ego threat is coming in and they would really struggle with it. And you would see higher levels of internalizing in that case as well. So with a grandiose narcissist, they brush it off because most people are, they know nothing and they know best, right? Mm. Although they still want that admiration.
Yeah.
You would see more vulnerable aspects within, more anxious aspects within. They're more anxious to get that admiration, or they're more anxious to seek that entitlement, for example, to get things, to feel entitled. Okay. Mm. There's more drive behind that in terms of needing it in some way.
Do they often need more pity from others? Is that a tactic of getting that validation?
Could be. That would be part of it, I guess. Yeah.
Mm. And what's one surprising fact about dark personality traits that most people don't know?
Everybody has some to some extent. That is a big question, to what extent. So, most people think about, when we talk about psychopathy or I think with narcissism, it changed a bit more recently because it became a lot more popular in the general media, social media, etc. But generally with psychopathy, people think, okay, psychopath is a serial killer and they're, somewhere. We always had this thing that whatever the films portrayed them to be as, basically Hollywood kind of a way of looking at it. But, that we have these traits that are dimensional in some way and across the population, we can measure them, that some people show these type of traits and henceforth also behaviors associated with them are at greater risk of aggressing, for example. I think that is really interesting, and maybe not many people have considered that. Okay. The other interesting thing is also that actually Some people with dark traits, with psychopathic traits or narcissistic traits, do exceptionally well in society.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have this concept of successful psychopathy. And these are individuals who, on the basis of their cold-heartedness, ruthlessness, and quick decision-making and quick rush kind of, you know, working through, they can do quite well in certain vocations, right? Where behavioral kind of expressions like this would be beneficial to get the job done, okay? So thinking of sometimes in politics.
Yeah.
Sometimes at CEO levels, sometimes in the financial sector. And surgeons need to be quite tough, right? They can't be too emotionally affected by seeing things they're seeing. And even within the army, for example, you have to make tough decisions. So, you know, you sometimes see people with certain traits will be selective in terms of the vocations they're choosing to do, right? Mm. We have that. We want to work in a vocation that we can thrive in. Okay. And we can only thrive in a vocation if our personality, the way we are, fits with that vocation, and we are able to work and fulfill the goals of that vocation. And so, henceforth, I think you have some sectors and areas where it can be beneficial to have some of these traits. I mean, even being Machiavellian and very strategic and manipulative can be very important in some jobs.
Mm. And it seems to be often in very high jobs or very high positions, which begs the question, like, is it kind of adaptive if you want to become super successful in whatever field you want to do, having at least some dark traits, maybe adaptive, like if you want to become a CEO, for example? Do you think that's the case?
All traits can be adaptive. All traits have costs and benefits attached to them, even neuroticism. Okay, so neuroticism is a very normal general personality trait. Okay, so that's your emotional stability. If you are highly neurotic, we are always conceptualizing that on the normal distribution, all our traits, okay? So if you're somewhere here in the middle, happy days, fine. If you're getting to the extreme end, so if you're highly neurotic, you are highly anxious and highly threat responsive and highly vulnerable, and you'll be vulnerable to internalizing disorders like depression, anxiety, etc., okay? So it's not ideal. If you're not at all neurotic, if you're extremely kind of low in neuroticism, well, this is what we see in psychopathy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If we are looking at agreeableness, for example, so agreeableness is one of our nicest traits, okay, our friendliness, nice non-antagonistic traits. If you're really low in agreeableness, again, we can see psychopathy or antisocial personality disorder, etc. on this end. If you're extremely highly agreeable, it can also be problematic, and it has also been linked to some of the PDs that have kind of attachment difficulties, for example, right? And they're highly dependent, for example, or it can also be individuals who are so agreeable, they will always be, their needs will always be pushed over because, they will just cope with it somehow. And everybody, you know, often they're being used in a way that is non-beneficial. So again, with your agreeableness, you have to have some healthy boundaries.
Mm.
So you can be the nicest person in the world, but you have to establish healthy boundaries that protect yourself.
Mm. Is that the typical empath and avoidant relationship combination? Is that all that's happening at play there, where someone's too empathetic and puts their needs too low and puts the other person's needs too high, and then the avoidant person takes advantage of that? Is that what's happening?
Could be. Yeah, that could be one of the problems that you see there. Really high levels of empathy, particularly really high levels of affective empathy. What happens there is that you take on the burden of the world, of everyone else, okay? And that will lead to burnout. So we know that in depression, for example, too high levels of affective empathy have been linked to depression. But interestingly, lower levels of cognitive So you have really high levels of affective leading to this kind of taking on the burden and too much pressure, kind of affective pressure, and too much low, right? And that gets you into a low. But once you are in the low and you're highly depressed because you are dealing with your own issues and it's so problematic that your perspective taking has diminished because at this point you can't think about somebody else anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you need to deal with your own problem. And so sometimes things can shift as well. Okay. But as with all traits, we always say having too much is not good. Having too little is not good. Find your healthy center somewhere.
Yeah. And
everything in moderation.
Yeah. And what trait do you think you have that might not be balanced? Or maybe you used to have a trait that you've, you know, managed?
Me personally.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sometimes quite impulsive, I would say. I'll do things sometimes quite impulsively. So I'm actively trying to be sometimes because I like, you know, like to do things on the spur of the moment sometimes and be quite spontaneous. But, you know, it doesn't always work when, you know, it was fine when I was younger. But in adult life where you have more responsibilities, you need to certainly contain yourself a little bit more. So that's one thing. And another thing probably that changed is maybe my levels of anxiety, I would say. Is it anxiety? I wouldn't consider myself a highly anxious person, but I'm certainly more worrying about things than I used to when I was younger. But again, I think that's pretty normal as you start having a family, you're having children, you're having to take care of other people. So you're really, you know, your personality needs to adapt to the context you're in. And actually, this is something that is healthy. Personality will be flexible and will adapt. And when we're looking at the context of personality disorder, we're always saying kind of that one of the kind of definitions around that would be that this flexibility is compromised. So, you know, they're not adapting healthily to different contexts. So let me give you an example as well. So we've always seen for many years that when they measured general personality traits, right, that the big five or big three, whatever it might be, hexagon, and they measure them in prison population. And they found reduced levels of extroversion, higher levels of neuroticism, low agreeableness, low conscientiousness, and so on and so forth. There's a certain profile that is more common in the prison population, let's say. Now, you can't quite say at this point is that this profile means you are, if you have this profile, means you're at higher risk to become an offender and get into prison. Because this profile really is just a reflection of being in prison.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. So if you are in a prison environment, which is a more threatening environment, and you might be more hostile in some ways, and you have to look over your shoulder more, and you have to worry more about what will happen to you, well, no surprise that you will become more neurotic. It also might be no surprise that you become less agreeableness, because you can't just be friendly and nice to everyone, because that can, you know, they could use it to their advantage, right? So. Sometimes when we are measuring traits, we need to be considerate or careful about the context in which we are measuring it and what it means. And so multiple studies are needed. The before longitudinal studies those that have looked at personality development and how personality remains stable and change over time, and then which traits have been linked to these and these outcomes later on, they are more indicative of the traits that might predict certain outcomes. Okay. Rather than the studies that look at this in a one cross-sectional moment.
Yeah, because I always think how much our environment and the conditions we're living in does influence our behavior. And if you're not having one of these disorders and you are flexible, you're going to adapt to that, whether you like it or not. Like, I always think if there was like an apocalypse or something, how many dark personality traits within the normal population would increase. Like during war, for example, you know, these soldiers go to this foreign land and do unspeakable things that they would never think of doing back at home.
Yeah. And that sometimes that might be direct response out of the kind of threat you know, when we are in a highly threatening environment, have a high threat response, a high fight, flight, freeze response will kick in as well. And so fight is part of this. Okay. So you will fight to survive. Okay. But at the same time, you might also panic, or you could, you know, there could be in freeze and not be able to react. How many people underestimate how they would react when they're under attack? I remember some years ago, we had just as an anecdote there, we ran a little study with some of our students about fear adrenaline training programs. So that program was specifically there to help women, for example, to know how to react when they're under attack and to actually react, because what often happens is that you freeze. And so this training was geared towards trying to get you to spring into action and to fight and all flight mode rather than freeze mode, okay, to overcome that freeze mode. And so in the flight training, we got attacked by a huge big predator and like a big helmet and everything. And I was taking part in it as well, and as part of the study, and it was quite interesting. But yeah, you know, you once you have this in front of you, you don't always know how you go. You know,
how did you react?
Well, part of the training was to react. So they trained us in a way that we had to, we were reacting. Yeah. We had to go for eyes, and who knows what. So it was quite funny, in some way. But actually, in the real world, it wouldn't be that funny at all. Mm. It was just a strange situation when we found ourselves in it at this point. But in the real world, it's really hard.
Mm. And what's one thing people get wrong about psychopaths?
Get wrong. Our assumption was always for many years that psychopathy is non-treatable. Mm. And you can't change them. This is the way they are, and that's it, right? And so there was a big stigma around that notion of non-treatability and non-treatment responsiveness. And so often people were a little bit kind of hands-on, not really, you know, wanting to engage in therapy or treatment because of that kind of upfront assumption that it's not going to help anyways. However, more lately, over the last decade or so, a few studies started emerging showing that some things can be changed can be worked on to improve, but it's how you do it, and it's maybe not always the standard way. So, for example, a classic study from the 80s, a seminal study was back then, that they were trying to do, apart from putting a psychopaths into kind of LSD communities. That didn't work out. Wasn't a good idea. they also tried to do more perspective training with them. And that was one of the seminal studies that made us thinking, leading also then later to the dark empath research. So they did the traditional perspective taking training that is often done with offending populations. So think about the victim, what did they think and how did they feel and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. What was shown then, those who had that training had an increased risk of reoffending after being released, right?
Hmm.
So it's almost you train them more tools of the trade, how to be better at right? Manipulating, basically.
Wow.
And so that, yeah, that was at the study, and then that was sometime in the 80s that the study suggested. So but that was one of the studies that made us think, okay, so actually, you know, that the perspective taking is really important for the manipulation. So maybe it's not really lacking in the first place, if anything, you do them. So I thought that was quite good. But what you would want to work on is maybe around the motivation. And remember, there's the egocentricity, so there needs to be some self-motivation. So in terms of changing attitudes or beliefs or behavior, you'd be working around the motivations of behavior. So almost maybe making why it would be good to be good to your employees, to the CEO, right?
Yeah.
Why you shouldn't be shouting at them, because actually you will increase productivity and get more money out of it if you're being kind to them.
Yeah. How would it benefit them?
So how do you twist that kind of goal orientation? It's all about goal orientation. What do you want to achieve? And the intention that underpins it. So then the motivation that underpins it. So I think stuff like this might be more beneficial in these contexts rather than appealing to their conscience, because if there's no conscience, you're talking into a black hole.
Yes. And how did dark traits manifest in different situations, and what are some notable examples?
So for example, we were talking about war or attack or threat. One thing about the psychopaths is, for example, that there wouldn't be much fear. They would be probably your ultimate warriors in that case because there would be, but the problem is that they would drag others into the abyss, right? And this is the danger. So when we were talking earlier about the successful psychopath and how these can be adaptive and successful, these traits in some cases, but often what you see there is that, yes, they can be successful to advance themselves, but they bring others down on the way on doing this. They will use somebody else's presentation and sell it off as their own, or somebody else's ideas and sell it off as their own, right? They would say, I'm the only capable person here to do the job because you are clearly not good enough for it. That would be something you'd be told. So it is those kind of job contexts that they will succeed because somebody else will see them, they're quite capable. Oh, they're getting the job done how swiftly and, tuck, tuck, tuck. But that meanwhile, other people around them are falling, they might not quite realize. So sometimes takes some time to pick up on that problem, right? So sometimes what we would need to look out for is the wider context in which somebody propels and exceeds and is successful. Because if this is on the back of other people and they're overstepping other people, then that's a clear danger sign. And that also means sooner or later, they will probably be doing some detrimental decision that either is financially or some other way detrimental to the organization or company itself, because they're often not for a long time on the top, because they will, bring it to ruin. They will bring the tower crashing down at some point. And so in the same, we would say about the army, if you've got somebody who has got no fear, they will just storm in, right? No, but the problem is if they take a whole attack team with them, they will bring the attack team down. Yeah. So the context is always really important.
And have you ever found anyone, or is it even possible to have all the dark personality traits or all the disorders all at once? Can all these traits be found in one person?
Well, yeah. So in our Dark Empath study, what we've shown is that people scored. So there were massive differences in the way how they scored on Machiavellianism, psychopathy, and narcissism. They were elevated across the three. Maybe a slight differences up and down, but nothing particularly meaningful. There was no significant difference between the profiles of the dark empath and the traditional dark traits in terms of how they scored on more in-depth measures of psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism. So in other words, these two profiles are the same in terms of their dark traits. They're just different in terms of their empathy. Okay. But also within the dark traits, they were all elevated to a certain extent, rather than particularly high on or more significantly high on one compared to the others, if that makes sense. So it didn't really matter in this case. And when you say in terms of diagnose, well, as I said before, the problem is, point one, Machiavellianism is not a diagnosis. So if you're diagnosed with psychopathy, you show Machiavellian traits. But you also show some narcissistic traits.
And some sadistic well.
And probably some sadistic, but sadism is often seen as a separate diagnosis because of the connotation with sexual sadism and the particular need to hurt. However, when we are looking at psychopathy, one of the classic conceptualizations over time, and many of the measurements will have things like, did you enjoy hurting animals? as a child, for example, right? So this is one of the early indicators people always used to quote as a classic thing and sign. And so probably because it already shows that colors and emotionalness. But then again, there's a difference. Am I hurting an animal just because I really don't care about them and I just do it for fun or something, or to impress the other kids? Or am I doing this because I take true pleasure from this?
Mm-hmm.
And so with a sadistic individual or in sadism, it is around pleasure and that reward sensation you get from inflicting pain on others that is particularly important and crucial, is that crux of this particular thing. But you're quite right, there's often a lot of overlap with psychopathy and sadism as well.
Yeah. And after the viewers and the audience listen or watch this interview, what's one action you think they could or should take from this?
Listen to your intuition. Listen to your feelings when you're interacting with other people. If they are being odd or strange, just put some boundaries in place. Doesn't mean that you can't interact with a dark empath. You can probably, where everybody probably, from the description of the dark empath, you can probably think about one or two friends that are a little bit like that, okay? And they can be quite fun to be around. I'm not saying push them out of your lives or anything. What I'm saying is, just think about who, we have the very inner circle, mid-circle, outer circle. We have these onion layers of circles of relationships. And how close you let someone to your heart, this is really then the question where you need to have clear boundaries. And I think it's also important to have clear boundaries in any relationships where your needs need to be considered. If you're in a relationship where your needs are disrespected and always, your boundaries are always being pushed and always being walked over, that's not a healthy relationship.
Mm.
When you feel you're being manipulated, when you feel you're being belittled, when you feel somebody is, making horrible jokes to put you down, to make you feel bad about yourself, all of these things, that's toxic, and you don't need that.
Yeah. Very good advice. And if you had one piece of advice for your 20-year-old self or 20-year-old Nadia, what would that advice be?
That's a really, really good question. Probably find the dark empath sooner. Get that good idea much sooner, then you have more time to look and research all of it. I think life takes and shapes you in the way it does. And sometimes, when you're younger, you need to learn some things, and having those healthy boundaries is probably something that I have learned and feel more comfortable and confident in establishing now than I did when I was younger. Because you always want to be, I'm one of those, I like to be, get on with people, be nice with everyone, and all of these things, but you don't have to be friends with everyone. You don't have to, everyone needs to like you, because it's normal. Sometimes we get on better with some people than with other people, and we sync more with some people, and finding the people that we sync best with and can interact with best and, feel comfortable being ourselves with, I think that's important.
Yeah. Find our tribe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Dr. Nadia Haim, ladies and gentlemen, Nadia, really appreciate your time. And I really enjoyed this. It's great to understand these dark personality traits a bit deeper. What are you currently working on?
Well, we're still working on the dark empath, more studies in relation to that, of course. So we've done some follow-up studies. We looked at this in kids as well. We looked at it in relation to emotional intelligence that we published. And it's not emotional intelligence that differs. I can already tell you that. Trying to find out more around this character, and also its replication, because we found it in that one study. It was amazing. But then how much could I trust it? So what we have done since is replicating it using different measures, different approaches, different models. It is a construct that holds, we have seen it again and again in different studies, different types of populations as well. Even adolescents and young people now as well. So it's quite interesting to see that, okay, we really need to be more aware and wary of this interaction between the dark traits and empathy and how that might determine different outcomes, rather than just having the baseline assumption that they all lack empathy, because it's not the case.
Yeah.
We've done a lot of this. We're also looking at the brain mechanisms involved. We're running some EEG studies. We're also trying to identify possibly some biomarkers in blood samples, so inflammation levels, for example, and other psychological markers, not just in relation to the dark empath and the dark traits, but also in relation to other psychological disorders and stuff. So it's generally the other research that goes on is around identifying those biomarkers. And if some of my research focuses around supporting individuals, so developing interventions techniques and evaluating treatments, for example, in the context of depression, in the context of trauma, so trauma-informed interventions. So I work a lot with looking at children who have been exposed to domestic violence and abuse and areas of abuse, and trying to have more trauma-informed targeted care to address the specific difficulties that we are seeing in those individuals. So that's very much the other side. It's not just that dark side. I'm also trying to see how, you know, at the light side, kind of how can we help people and make people feel better.
Yeah, well, it sounds fascinating, and I'd love to do a round two to discuss that in the future for sure. The brain scans sound really cool as well.
Right, right, yes. Well, we mostly use EEG, but there's plenty of studies that have conducted brain scans as well. Some really interesting research out there around how the brain is so important, but not just the brain. What we are looking at now is beyond the brain, because we have for many years studied the brain as, okay, the brain and how it underpins or is linked to behavior or difficulties, cognitive difficulties, affecting, et cetera. But, you know, we always took the head off. We just look at people's heads as if the body doesn't exist. So a lot of the research we are doing now is actually using an embodied brain approach, which looks at the interaction between body and brain. So it looks at things like our microbiota, our inflammation levels in the body, how stress and inflammation and trauma is linked to psychological disorders, for example. Looks at endocrine levels as well, looks at nutrition, the impact of healthy nutrition, and what nutritional aspects are beneficial to reduce inflammation or to improve our microbiome, and henceforth have an impact on our brain function as well. So we are not studying the brain in isolation, brain and behavior in isolation anymore, but we are now looking at more holistic kind of embodied brain approach.
That's so fascinating. I'm going to have to start exploring that as well, do some research on that. That's awesome. And where can people go if they want to find more of your work?
There's quite a few of our published studies, the academic studies, they are open source. So many of them are freely available on the internet. But otherwise, I've also given quite a few interviews and published within The Conversation around the dark empath and around five things you didn't know about psychopathy in the conversation. That's also freely available. There's been a couple of articles published in BBC Science Focus as well recently, in the last couple of years. And a third one has literally just come out around, that one will be around successful psychopathy. And the other ones were on dark empath and vulnerable narcissism. But if you come to my website as well and my NTU website, I think there's links towards those as well.
Awesome. I'll leave that in the show notes for everyone to check out. Thank you so much, Nadia. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Jacob, for having me. It's great.
If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My pro remote podcast blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Promo Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.